In my school system growing up, there was one building just for 7th and 8th grade. It was the junior high building. It was an ancient building. It was like 110 years old. But that was the junior high building. Everyone from the school system fed into that building for 7th and 8th grade. And when I was in 7th grade, my homeroom teacher, he made it clear at the beginning of the year, he said, I am your homeroom teacher. What you need to know is that my homeroom wins the food drive every year. That's what we do. That's who we are. We're going to win. I won last year. I won the year before. And I won the year before that. And this year's not going to be any different. I mean, from like day one, he's like, it's coming up in November around Thanksgiving, but get ready, okay? You're going to carry forward the legacy here. And so we bought in because the winning homeroom got a pizza party. And so we said, yeah, you had us at pizza, right? Just, that's no problem. So we're getting psyched, we're getting prepared, and sure enough, it comes around, and we were all in. And I will say, some of you know, the school fundraisers, I hated them. I am a terrible door-to-door salesman. There's almost nothing worse than I can imagine than trying to sell stuff I would never want to other people. I would people would answer the door, and I'd say, hey, I'm selling this for my school. Are you interested? And they would say no, and I would say, I know, I'm not either. Like, I'd feel so bad. But this I could actually do. So they encouraged us. They said, look, what we want you to do, it's a food drive. You're to bring stuff from your house. And if you want, you can go throughout your neighborhood, see if your neighbors have any donations you want to make. And I thought, you know what? That I can do. And I did. I mean, my neighbors, they knew my brothers. I had one brother that was a slick salesman. That was not me. I did it. I went door to door, anything you want to donate, and people said, sure. And all week, so it's week-long food drive, we're ahead all week, and we're thinking, yeah, we got it in the bag, pizza party is ours. And then we got to Friday, and we received just a devastating blow. We found out another class, one kid had gotten his dad at Sam's Club to buy like 3 packs of ramen noodles. And, it was like 24 per pack. He got to school, cut those open, and they counted every single pack of ramen noodles separately, okay? And all our lead all week just gone, and we lost, all right? So I'll tell you, the most interesting thing about this is that you might think that we would be like disappointed, or that we would think, man, how great this food shelf is going to get so much more food. Nope. Nobody mentioned that. No one thought of that. We jumped immediately to injustice and judgment. We were like, that class did not follow the spirit of the food drive, right? They are supposed to bring stuff from their house. We thought, man, we were so self-righteous. We're like, you know what? We did it. Our teacher's telling us, you guys did it the right way. That class, they just bought the victory. They bought the trophy. And we're like, yeah, we did do it the right way. They did. In 5 seconds, we were all sitting in judgment on this other class. We don't even know who's in this class, but we know they didn't do it the right way. I am convinced, from 7th grade on at least, that one of the most difficult things in life is to be convinced that you are in the right, to work hard at it, and then to not become self-righteous when you start to succeed. I mean, it's so easy to shake our heads at the self-righteousness of the Pharisees and the scribes. But the truth is, my whole class, teacher included, found it so easy to feel self-righteous about how we conducted a food drive. Okay? And I promise you, if I just thought about it for 5 more minutes up here, I could come up with a sillier example. Judging others always seems to come so easily to us in our fallen humanity, and doubly so when we're convinced that we are in the right, and when we've worked hard to live in the right. In our passage today in Matthew 7, 1 through 12, Jesus is starting to wrap up the Sermon on the Mount. We've been in the Sermon on the Mount for a few weeks now, and what I'd like us to consider before we dive in is what Jesus' audience has heard up to this point. And what we have heard, right? So sort of on a high level, they have heard a vision from Jesus. He's cast a vision for a new kind of kingdom and a new way of inaugurating that kingdom, not suddenly and with violence, but slowly, starting with ourselves through individual transformation. And Jesus then goes on to explain how that's going to start, how that's going to work, what he means by starting with ourselves. With respect to the law, he says, I'm calling you to a greater and higher standard of righteousness. With respect to religious practices, he's calling them to purer motives. Now, I want you to consider what the audience might start to think, especially if they're persuaded by Jesus, right? And we should be able to do it. We're his audience for this also. And, you know, if you're here, I'm guessing most of you find what Jesus has said pretty persuasive. What are they thinking? What are we thinking as this vision that Jesus gives us of a greater righteousness, a greater covenant faithfulness starts to sink in? Well, if my seventh grade class is any indication, it's not going to take long for those convinced by Jesus to start looking around and saying, you know, now that Jesus brings it up, there really is a lot of inferior righteousness that I see around me, right? I mean, the minute we find that step that we can take that's going to raise us up morally just a little bit, the first thing you want to do is start looking down at the people beneath you, right? And Jesus knows this. And I think here again, we just see, man, I just keep being struck week in and week out. Just the unique and unparalleled insight into human nature that we have in this message on the mountain. Jesus understands us. He knows where this is headed. He knows how tempting it's going to be for those followers who do start taking those difficult steps to a greater righteousness not to immediately turn around and sit in judgment. And so as he starts to wrap up, guess what he does? He says, and now that you've heard about all this, now that you've been called to a greater righteousness, let me warn you about sitting in judgment on others. Look with me at Matthew 7, 1 through 5. Jesus starts simply by saying, do not judge, or you too will be judged. For in the same way you judge others, you will be judged. And with the measure you use, it will be measured to you. Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own eye? How can you say to your brother, let me take the speck out of your eye, when all the time there is a plank in your own eye? You hypocrite. First take the plank out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. You know, in this little unit of teaching here, we get, in verse 1, we get a simple warning, followed by an explanation of the warning, followed in verses 3 through 5 by an illustration that highlights the absurdity of the behavior Jesus is warning against. Now, the warning is simple and straightforward, but I think it is often misunderstood. Jesus just says, do not judge or you too will be judged. Now, this doesn't mean that we should never concern ourselves with the behavior of others. We know that's not right because, A, Jesus ends this section by saying how you can actually see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. And, you know, just to pick at one other example, in Matthew 18, he explicitly directs his followers, hey, if you see that a brother or sister is in sin, take someone with you and gently correct them. He calls us to do that for one another. But that, what he is calling them to there, is fundamentally different from what Jesus is warning against here, which is against harsh, smug judgment paired with a naive lack of self-examination. The shortest illustration makes this clear. So look at how the illustration highlights the point Jesus is making. Here in his little illustration, the hypocrite presumes to see and remove the speck from a brother's eye when there is a plank in his own eye, obscuring his vision, right? Now, I think it's worth noting, this is it's an intentionally ridiculous image. It's supposed to be ridiculous because the point is not just that the hypocrite is in greater need of correction, though that's certainly part of the point. But another part of the point Jesus is making here is that the hypocrite's own sin so fully obscures their own vision that they cannot possibly be helpful to another person. Just to bring home the point, I don't know why this just came to me. I think because You know, I'm not squeamish about a lot of stuff, but I can't, if I even think about like needles or blades near eyeballs, I can't, you know, I don't know what I'm going to do if I need that. I'm going to need to be like totally put under. So I don't know why. This just came to me this week. I was just thinking, yeah, imagine you're in the operating room for delicate eye surgery. They're coming at your eyeball with sharp things, right? And as you're laying there, they're about to, you know, do whatever, put you under whatever they do. Your surgeon walks in and immediately runs into like a table and goes, man, I didn't even see that there. And then they kind of go around the edge and they immediately run into a chair and go, man, where'd that come from? I mean, are you going through with that surgery? I'm not, right? I am gonna smack the whatever out of the anesthesiologist's hand and go, we're done, this is off. Right? If you cannot see clearly enough to avoid a table, I'm not letting you near my eyeball with a laser. Okay? That's just not gonna happen. Right? That is Jesus' point here. He warns us to be slow and careful when we correct others for two reasons. And the first one is, we gotta be cautious because our own sin is going to impair our vision. It's going to impair our vision. You'll notice this bears a striking resemblance to Jesus' famous invitation, you know, let him without sin cast the first stone. It's the same kind of idea. You know, not only as human beings are we unable to fully see and know the heart and motives of other people, even what we see, we cannot see clearly. And that should make us exceedingly careful, so cautious, because even what we see, we do not see clearly. That's the first reason. The second reason that Jesus provides here, and it's one that might make us a little uncomfortable, but I want to just accept that. I think the discomfort is part of his point here. His initial explanation in verse 2, for in the same way you judge others, you too will be judged. With the measure you use, it will be measured to you. Now, it's interesting. Jesus doesn't specify who the, you know, reciprocal judge is in this situation. It might be that he's implying that if you are someone who extends no grace to others, that the other people in your community are going to notice that, and they're not going to be very inclined to extend grace to you. That's certainly a possibility. But it's also possible that the implied other judge here is God. And that might make you a little nervous. I think it should. It makes me a little bit nervous. But, you know, that would actually fit with what Jesus has just instructed them in the Lord's Prayer, which we just read together. Father, forgive us as we forgive others, right? It employs a similar kind of logic. And it's possible Jesus is leaning on both. Certainly, we can't rule out the second implication. But here's the thing. Whatever the exact thing Jesus has in mind, here's how I think we should receive it. Here's how I think about it. You know, one day we are all going to stand before a holy God with our heart and lives laid bare, right? And there will, I promise you, that will be the time that you will be more cognizant than in any other time of your existence of your deep need for the mercy and forgiveness of God. And so Jesus is just asking, knowing that we're all going to be there one day, as God is looking at your life, do you want him to see somebody who has been harsh and ungracious with others? Or someone who's been merciful and understanding? When you're standing there, do you want God to see somebody who has been reckless with the hearts of other people? Or someone who has been cautious and humble? That's an easy question. That's an easy question. You know, I initially, when I thought of that opening illustration, I didn't have this next part in mind, but as I was working on the sermon, I remembered there's a reprise to that story, all right? There's a coda, which is that eventually we made it to eighth grade, and you don't stay with the same homeroom, you kind of get broken up, but a bunch of us ended up in the same homeroom together in eighth grade, and guess what? November comes, food drive runs around, and you want to take any guess what we did? Our teacher in eighth grade did not care about the food drive at all. That was not her thing. She was like, look, you guys do what you want to do. She did not want to facilitate the pizza party with a bunch of teenagers. But we said, no. A couple of us said to the class, listen, starting today, you guys need to start begging, pleading, and guilting your parents, especially if they have a Sam's Club membership. You know, those packs of ramen are not expensive, and if we can all bring in one or two, we're going to bury the second place class, all right? And we did. And not a single one of us experienced a moment of conflicted conscience. Looking back, we sat in self-righteous judgment on that other class, and then in eighth grade, we immediately employed the same tactic. And I think one good lesson to take away from that is that we all should be merciful. We should all be understanding, because all of us eventually are going to need that mercy. All of us. Jesus, friends, has called us to a greater righteousness. He has, to a deeper sense of covenant faithfulness. But as we strive after that, we should be slow to judge, because none of us see clearly, and eventually, we are all going to need mercy. We're all going to need mercy. Before we get to the next topic, I want to take a minute to talk about verse 6 all by itself. So right after, if we pick up right where we stopped before, Jesus continues on, and he says, "Do not give to dogs what is sacred. Do not throw your pearls to pigs. If you do, they may trample them under their feet and turn and tear you to pieces." Now, I'll just say, there's significant uncertainty over what Jesus is getting at here. If you read three commentaries, you probably get three different takes on the passage. One, I would say, sort of prevalent view, something I heard a lot growing up, is that because elsewhere in the gospel, Jesus tells a parable about the kingdom, where he compares participation in his kingdom to finding a pearl of great worth, people have transposed that back and said, well, this must be about the kingdom also and about offering the kingdom to people who aren't ready to receive it. I've never found that persuasive, partly because that's not how any of us talk. You know, if you assume that some sort of figure of speech I'm using now, I'm using it in exactly the same way I did 3 months ago, don't hold me to that, okay? I probably don't even remember that. And second of all, it doesn't fit with the context at all. That's what I always thought, okay, Jesus does talk about that, but it seems, why drop it in right here? So what I think is more likely is that Jesus is following up on his warning about reckless judgment, and here he's issuing a warning in the other direction, right? I think the pearls in this saying are the wise and gentle correction from a friend. They're wise and gentle correction from a friend. Guys, that kind of correction from someone who actually cares deeply about you and your well-being and who carefully and gently comes alongside you to correct you, that is precious and valuable to the wise. And it is, right? If I'm in sin, if I'm engaging in self-destructive disobedience to my God, I want someone who is going to correct me. And if I can be picky, I would love someone who's going to do it gently and who has my best interest in mind. Guys, that is a precious and valuable thing, like a pearl, all right? But it's also something, and I'm guessing we all have experience with this, that's likely to be scorned by the foolish. In other words, I see a balance here to the earlier warning. Jesus says, look, you look to yourself first. Do not engage in reckless judgment. And even when you're offering careful, thoughtful correction, be wise about who you're offering it to. Don't offer it to those who will not receive it. I mean, it's interesting. It's kind of a violent little image here. But the more I thought about this, you know, maybe you've experienced this. Even humble, thoughtful correction, it's risky. It can be costly. Even when you're doing it with the best of intentions, you're doing it so gently, it can still damage a relationship, end a relationship, if that person just isn't in a place to hear that. And Jesus is saying, look, there's a time to do it out of the right motives, gently and humbly. But even then, be thoughtful about how you do it. Be thoughtful about how you do it. All right. Let's look now at verses 7 through 10 here. Jesus is pivoting to a different topic altogether. But there's an interesting thread of connection here, I think, which is that underneath this one is, again, a failure to see clearly. Look with me at verses 7 through 10. Jesus says, ask and it will be given to you. Seek and you will find. Knock and the door will be opened to you. For everyone who asks receives. The one who seeks finds. And the one who knocks, the door will be opened. Which of you, if your son asks for bread, would give him a stone? Or if he asks for fish, would give him a snake? If you then, who are evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father in heaven give good gifts to those who ask him? Now, just like before, I think to understand this initial invitation properly requires looking at it together with the illustration that Jesus provides with it. And the invitation here, very simply, verses 7 and 8, is just to pray more, to pray much more, actually. You can see Jesus here builds on the previous instruction we've seen in past weeks, right? You go back a couple weeks, he taught his followers, pray to God as your heavenly Father. Here, too, he references God as a Father. He's building on that. He builds on what Paul talked about last week, about worry. Right? The antidote to worry is confidence that God is, in fact, a loving Father who is willing and able to give his children all that they need. And it's precisely on that point, on the character of God, on seeing God clearly, that Jesus seeks to correct our vision. In verses 9 through 11, Jesus makes a how much more argument. This is a rhetorical device Jesus uses often. He asks, it's a rhetorical question, and the answer is meant to be obvious, right? So he looks out at his audience, and he says, look, you tell me, which one of you, who among you, if your child came to you hungry and asked for bread, would give him a stone and then laughed when they couldn't eat it? Like, who would do that? Who among you, if your child comes to you hungry asking for a fish, would give them a serpent? And the answer, of course, I mean, the crowd's looking at each other going, no one would do, we don't know anyone who would do that. Even the person you think of as the worst parent you know wouldn't do that. And Jesus agrees. He says, that's exactly right. And if we, deeply flawed, fallen, selfish human beings, if we wouldn't do that, if we know how to give our children what they need and we give it to them, how much more will a perfect, good, and loving God provide us with the gifts that we need, the good gifts that we need? Let me offer one little insight here that it's easy for us, it's maybe less obvious to us who have grown up in a culture steeped in Christianity. And that's that part of God's goodness, and you can see this in here if you look carefully, is that he gives us what's good for us from his perspective, not necessarily from ours. And here again, I think the parenting analogy is helpful. Look, you don't even have to be a parent. If you're just around kids for a little bit, you will figure out, left to their own devices, kids will try to live on dessert and soda. I mean, they'll try. They'll give it a run, right? If you leave them alone in a room unsupervised with all kinds of food, none of those kids are going to gravitate naturally to the vegetable tray, okay? They're going straight for the Oreos. They're going straight for the soda. I was just at the men's retreat this weekend, and it turns out that men, left to their own devices, we will try the same thing, okay? So here's the point. Part of what Jesus is trying to say here is that a good parent does not always give their children what they ask for. They give them the good things that they need, as the parent knows that they need them. And this is a sharp, I think we kind of take this for granted. We seldom think of God as giving things we ask for and then laughing when they turn out to be bad for us. But that is a result of a transformation of culture because of the Christian faith. In the Roman world, The Roman gods did this kind of thing all the time. Someone would pray and ask for something, and a god would answer that prayer and then watch and laugh purely for their own entertainment, as getting what they asked for destroys their lives. And Jesus says, and he knows that they live in that world, their vision's been distorted by that. And he looks at these people and he says, your God is not like that. He is a good and loving Father. He gives us what we need, not necessarily what we ask for, because he loves us. Jesus invites his followers to make prayer their first resort, not their last resort, their first resort, because their God is present and he is good. And he will provide us with what we need, not necessarily what we ask for. I just want to tell one more story here from my own life that's also, it's kind of an example of that, and also speaks to the first point this morning as well. I will say, my children will tell you, my wife will tell you, I do get frustrated while driving from time to time with the way that other people drive, and sometimes just with the fact that other people are out there driving while I'm trying to drive. All right, I've been known to get frustrated, but I have never understood and been anywhere close to climbing out of my own car out of rage. Right? I see stories of people doing that, and I've seen videos of people doing that, and I've always thought, what in the world is wrong with these people? I have never been so upset that I would get out of my car and walk up to the car of a total stranger. I don't know what they have in the car. I don't know where they are in their headspace. Like, everything's on the table. Like, you know, the odds of a good outcome, whatever they were, drop near zero, and the odds of a horrible outcome just skyrocket. I just thought, these people are nuts. Why does anyone do that? And then, a few weeks ago, a month and a half ago, my oldest daughter, learning to drive, brand new driver, she is driving us home from my in-law's house. We've got the sticker on the back, student driver, nice and big, and it's nighttime, and she's coming up to a tricky intersection where there's a turn lane that is both a turn lane into a strip mall. And then if you keep going, it becomes the turn lane for the road we're trying to turn right onto. And so she, I think, had a moment of indecision, didn't know if she needed to get over now or later. And so we're saying, hey, get over now. That's the lane you want to be in. And, I mean, this is like super early days, very first times on the road. So she slowly makes her way over. But it's fine. There's no one right behind her. It's dark. And then she starts to slowly navigate this turn, and she's doing a great job. But it's slow going, all right? In the meantime, this other car flies up behind her and immediately starts honking the horn just over and over again, you know. And I got to tell you, it was like not an out-of-body experience exactly, but I can see she's getting stressed out, and so there's half of me that's trying to be calm and I'm telling her. I can see she's getting anxious. I'm saying, hey, don't worry. You're doing a great job. In 3 seconds, this guy's going to be able to go around you and fly down the road. He'll be fine. There's another half of me that if we had somehow come to a stop, I'm glad we don't have to know if I would have gotten out of the car. I'm already envisioning ripping the magnet off the back of my car, smacking it on his windshield, and just screaming, student driver. I'll say I'm not proud of it. I was so angry. And it happened so fast, all right? And I just thought, this guy is just the worst. I mean, what a terrible human being, right? Then, about 2.5 weeks ago, I'm driving down the road. It's one lane, you know, 45 miles an hour. And one of my least favorite thing happens, which is somebody pulled out last second right in front of me, and then proceeded to drive the next 2 miles at 15 miles an hour under the speed limit. And I just think, oh, you had to get out in front of me, but then we're going to go extra slow. And I went from zero to highly frustrated like that. And God let me be frustrated for just long enough before I noticed, kind of small, off down in the corner, a magnet that said, student driver. Now, you laugh, but God just said to me in that moment, you are the guy today. It's you. And I just thought, I am today. And I thought, I don't think I'm a terrible person. I'm not a menace to society. And yet here, where somebody else needed 5 seconds of understanding and grace from me, I couldn't find it. Now, thankfully, I didn't lay on the horn. I'm just not a horn guy. You know, if I was, I probably would have. Look, as we noted at the beginning of this series on the Sermon on the Mountain, Jesus, one of the great distinctives of Jesus' kingdom is that it starts with us. Man, the easiest and most natural human instinct is to point the finger at others. I mean, that is literally the first and second response to the first human sin we know about. Adam pointed to Eve and said it's her fault. Eve pointed at the serpent and said it's the serpent's fault. In striking contrast to that, Jesus calls for us to start by looking first to ourselves, because he knows that if we tend to our own eyes first, we will see God and others more clearly. I've said this before, but one way to summarize Jesus' ethic is that he calls us to be ruthless with ourselves, to hold ourselves to the highest standard, and to be gracious toward others. And I note that this is the reverse of most of our inclinations. Most of us, our natural inclination is to give ourselves every excuse and then to leave no understanding for others. When it's our kid driving, we expect some grace. We demand it. When it's somebody else, we often offer none. Jesus invites us, he commands us to invert that. Hold yourself to the highest standard and be gracious to others. Friends, I've been meditating on that this week. I mean, and I just, every time I think about that, a church that strives to do that makes the gospel credible and irresistible. And like almost everything in this teaching, I find the core of today's message almost bafflingly simple and deeply insightful at the same time. I mean, that includes Jesus' summary verse for today, verse 12. We call it the golden rule, right? Verse 12, wrapping this up, Jesus says, "So in everything, do to others what you would have them do to you." Look, if you were raised in church, if your kid's been raised in church, you know we teach this early, right? We get it to kids early, and here's the thing. Kids understand it. They hear it, they can repeat it, and they can understand it. It's a simple heuristic. And yet Jesus says, right after this, this sums up all of the law and the prophets. Friends, that's a bold claim. I don't know if you've looked at the size of the Old Testament lately. There's a lot there. And he says, no, do this, and you're not going to go too far wrong. So God, what he fundamentally asks of his people is to treat other people the way we would want other people to treat us. So the next time, you know, you or I are ready to speak words of judgment to people, either to their face or behind their back, we should just ask ourselves, is this what we would want that person to do for us? A child can understand the principle, but to put it into practice is the work of a lifetime. But it's the work of a good life and a life that fulfills the law and the prophets. Would you pray with me as we close? Heavenly Father, I just want to continue the theme of gratefulness this morning. Lord, any time I think about this, and I know there's other faiths, other people who believe with deep conviction the way that I believe with deep conviction, but what I always circle back to, when I look at the core of who you have called us to be in Christ, I just can't imagine anything better. I see in your words the person I want to be. Lord, I pray, help us as we receive this teaching from you, from Jesus. Lord, I pray that would just resonate deeply within us. Help us, Father, to long for that, to strive after it. And then, as we strive, help us, Lord, to be gracious and understanding with others as they continue the same journey as well. In your name we pray. Amen.